Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
I'm Debbie Brock, founder of Homeopathy World Community, speaking with our co-host, Alan Phillips. Today is December 2, 2010, and you're listening to show number 7 of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the United States. Thank you so much for joining us. I wanted to introduce our co-host again, Alan Phillips, for those who are joining us for the first time. Alan, are you there?
I am. Debbie, how are you this morning?
I'm doing great. Glad to have you. We're going to have a little talk, and I just wanted to let folks know that you are one of the nation's leading vaccine rights attorneys and that you advise individuals, families, other attorneys, groups, and organizations throughout the United States on vaccine exemption and waiver rights, that you support legislative initiatives aimed at expanding the vaccine freedom of choice, and you are published internationally on vaccine health and legal matters. You regularly are traveling, as I know when I try to reach you. You're going to rallies, conferences, you're on the radio quite a bit, and you've even done television shows on vaccine rights. A little bit more introduction is, you were telling me that you didn't actually become a lawyer until your first child was 8 years old, and that you stumbled on the vaccine issue when he was just an infant, and a friend told you something about their child having permanent damage from a vaccine. That's when you began to research and write about the vaccine issue. You want to tell us any more about your history in that regard?
Well, it was interesting. The first time I took my first child in for his new baby checkup, of course, we got what I now know was what's called a vaccine information statement that doctors are legally required to give to patients or parents. And it alluded a little bit to the possible risk of harm from vaccines, but not in a way that you could really directly compare, and I did some very simple math in my head and figured out that there, based on the information they gave me, there was about 1 in 10 million chance that my son would die from pertussis, but there was a 1 in 1,700 chance that he'd have a severe reaction from the vaccine, according to their own information. And I pointed that out to the doctor, and he was just, flabbergasted. He was just like, no, you know, it's chances are 1 in a million. It's not, nothing's going to go wrong. I've never seen that in my practice. I mean, he was all but yelling at me.
And so do we have kind of statistics now about the ratios of potential adverse reactions for the different vaccinations? Is that something that we can find on the internet or even on their own government websites? Is that available to us?
Yes and no. I mean, the yes is that there is what's called a vaccine adverse event reporting system, and they do keep track of reports of adverse reactions. The problem is that even the FDA and the CDC have acknowledged at various times that the overwhelming majority of adverse events are never reported. So there are figures we can look at, but they are not by any means a reliable indication of the scope of the problem. They are merely the proverbial tip of the iceberg. So, And this is part of the inherent difficulty with the idea of having vaccine mandates at all, that we know at this point in time that any widely used vaccine is going to have a death and disability rate. It is, to quote a book title, a shot in the dark when you get a vaccine as to whether or not your child's going to have a reaction, how severe the reaction is going to be, when it's going to show up. The reaction can show up immediately or years later, even decades later, where we've had doctors have found SV40, known early polio vaccine contaminant, in cancers decades after people received the vaccine. So, you know, there are effects that can take many, many years to show up. But since, of course, you can't count what you don't know, so it's only a guess that anybody can make as to what percentage of actual occurring adverse events don't get reported, but doctors pretty routinely will tell people when there is a health problem following a vaccine that it's not connected to the vaccine, and that is probably the reason that so many are not reported.
Alan, this seems to have really been an incredible impetus, a serious thing for you to have changed careers because of this issue. And what I'm asking kind of is, one in 1,750 or one in 1,750, do you consider that a high risk? In other words, did you feel that was, are the numbers that you're reading in the brochures telling you that you have to be cautious, or did you feel like this is not a risk-taking venture because the numbers are not warranting concern? That's kind of where I'm going with the percentages of how many would possibly have an adverse effect to the number of children being inoculated.
Well, the presumption with vaccines and with legislatures around the country and federal agencies in federal arenas mandating vaccines, the presumption is that they provide a net benefit. And the argument is that even now, I mean, the federal government has paid out close to $2 billion over the last about 25 to 30 years for death and disability caused by vaccines. Nobody at this point in time can say that vaccines aren't dangerous. The question is it a net benefit? What's the scope of the problem? Are there other alternatives and those kinds of things? But as a matter of the current state of the law, by virtue of the fact that the mandates are in place, the presumption is at this point that there's a net benefit. Now, the information I was given as a new parent on the vaccine information statement was not presented in a way that you could look at it and conclude that the risk of vaccines was greater than the risk of the disease. I had to take the information given to me on that statement and convert the apples to oranges so I could compare oranges to oranges, so to speak. And when I did that, I saw that it looked like there was a greater risk from the vaccine than from the disease based on the information they gave me. And when I presented that to the doctor, he got very angry, yelled at me and stormed out of the room saying, as he was closing the door, I guess I should read that sometime. So here's a doctor arguing information that he hasn't even read. You know, I mean, how busy can you be that you can't even read the information on one page that you're handing all your patients? I mean, that's just absurd. But that's typical from people tell me.
Right.
Doctors don't even know they don't know what are in the vaccines. They don't even read the information they give you. So, you know, I mean, I'm sure they all mean well.
Maybe one of these days I'll do a listing and read out what is the components and all of the different chemicals and things that are in a vaccine. That might take a half an hour.
That could certainly be a whole show, reading and then explaining briefly what some of those are. But there are neurotoxins and every other kind of toxin you can think of, you know, give or take, you know, that are among the vaccines in there. So it's no wonder that we're having the reactions that we're having. The problem in terms of the larger vaccine debate is that we don't know the scope of the problem, and and that raises some very serious questions as to who should be required to take what risks in what situation and who gets to decide. But again, those ultimately become legislative issues because those decisions to a large extent have already been made for us. And if we disagree with the decisions as the current state of the law reflects, then we have an obligation to become involved legislatively to change the boundaries, you know, change those requirements to give more freedom of choice because we have a severe lack of that.
Lack of being able to have that freedom of choice. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, too much restrictions on our ability to make informed choices.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the reasons that I really admire you is because not only did you take care of yourself and do the investigative reporting, but you actually shared this information. You gathered it and tabulated it, and it made sense to you, and you wanted to find out from other people if they're thinking the same thing or if anybody else is interested in this particular issue, which could be a life-changing event for many families who would have to deal with adverse reactions with their children. And so you wrote the report, Dispelling Vaccination Myths. It was an article that was published around the world. It was even translated into Russian, Chinese, and several European languages in the late 1990s. So we're talking about 20 years ago you were doing this. And it's been used even in medical school classrooms in three different countries. Is it being used in medical schools in this country? I don't know.
I had a professor contact me right here in my own backyard at the University of North Carolina. She was using it for a class there. I don't know, you know, if anybody is still using it or not. But I tried to get it published once and was turned down. And then somebody put it on the internet without even telling me, which was fine.
Oh.
But it started getting spread around, and I had people start contacting me just and even as recently as the last year or so, I had somebody contacting me asking to publish it again. It's just been – it took on a life of its own, and I just sort of sat back and watched, and it was just fascinating. I mean, what you read about where this article has been and what has happened to it sounds like I made it a part-time job to try to get it out there, and I honestly didn't do that. It sort of took off on its own, and I mean, all with my full – support, but there's no shortage of information out there. But at the time that I started writing this, I did not see anyone who had really kind of put together in a concise way introductory information. And so that was the purpose of the article. I mean, I even had somebody ask me once if I wanted to turn it into a book, somebody who was interested in publishing, expanding it into a book and publishing it. And that was when I was in law school, so I didn't have time to do that. But I think it's more effective as an article. There's plenty of information out there, but to get it concisely together in the format that I did, I hadn't seen before. And a lot of people will read a 15- or 20-minute article who won't have time to read any of the excellent books that are out there.
So it's a good introduction. And you learned in there that the health authorities credit vaccines for disease declines, and that they assure us of their safety and effectiveness. Yet you said that these assumptions are directly contradicted by their own government statistics, published medical studies, the Food and Drug Administration and Centers for Disease Control, the CDC reports, and the opinions of credible research scientists from around the world. In fact, infectious diseases declined steadily for decades prior to mass immunizations. Doctors in the U.S. report thousands of serious vaccine reactions each year, which you mentioned, the VAERS, including hundreds of deaths and permanent disabilities. Fully vaccinated populations have experienced epidemics, and researchers attribute dozens of chronic immunological and neurological diseases that have risen dramatically since the recent decades to mass immunization campaigns. That's a lot of information there, and you have done a lot of research into safeguarding your own family and your children regarding vaccinations and looking at actual reports and facts that have been published by government agencies. So where can they find that if they just go to the FDA or the CDC reports?
The spelling vaccination myths article is a real good introduction to the topic, and there again are a number of books out there, a number of websites. The federal authorities, I'll put it like this, I'm convinced at this point that vaccination policy is exactly that. It's a policy. It's politically based. It's not truly based on objective science. And there was a real interesting, the Union of Concerned Scientists did a poll of federal agency scientists back in 2005 across the board, in and out of the healthcare arena. And they found a significant percentage of research scientists who were saying that their research at times was either being ignored or suppressed, or that policy was being implemented directly contrary to the findings in their research. These are very disturbing findings, and what it tells us is that the way that politics works is not the ideal objective machinery that we would like to see, that is looking out for people's best interests, but rather looking is apparently heavily influenced or swayed at times by agendas other than public interest, what's truly and scientifically verifiably in the public interest. And we know at this point as well that medical research is not at all always objective, and there's plenty of information to substantiate that claim, including studies that are published in the medical literature that look at studies. Mm-hmm. Find, for example, there was a study that found that studies financed by the pharmaceutical industry had a much higher percentage of success when evaluating drugs than those, you know, published by disinterested sources. There's a severe lack of objectivity and regarding science in federal agencies generally. It's unpredictable, and yet we tend in the public to defer to them.
We rely on them.
We
expect them to care for us. That's why there is government, supposedly.
Well, that's why they're there.
To care for the people. Yeah.
And so it's reasonable, you know, to a point to do that. But when you look at what is happening beneath the surface, it becomes clear that that's not something that we can really consistently rely on without applying some scrutiny to seeing, well, in this particular instance, is it really an objective policy decision or not? Because many times it turns out it isn't. And I'm convinced. I mean, just last December, the head of the CDC announced her job change from CDC director to president of Merck Vaccines. You have that kind of a revolving door between government and industry. You know, there can't be any clear objectivity going on in the federal agency and its decisions, at least not in any reliable, consistent and reliable way. I can't say that it's never objective or never accurate, only that I'm convinced at this point that it's not reliable, that we need to apply scrutiny. Now, I don't know how you do that, but we live in a country where the immunization policy is dictated by the vaccine industry. The ACIP is the agency that provides policy decisions to the CDC, and the CDC's these policy decisions are generally enacted into law by the individual states, a high level of consistency with CDC recommendations, and that comes from the ACIP, which is people right out of the vaccine industry. So it doesn't, you know, it's the conflicts of interest are blatant and dramatic. So it's, again, it's not something that we can rely on. But the question comes down of, can you make an informed choice or not? And regardless of what you think about the credibility of federal agencies, the issue of informed choice for many people is just a fundamental rights issue. It should be a fundamental right that you're talking about healthcare of individuals, that the government shouldn't be making sweeping decisions about people collectively, but rather individuals should be making those decisions in consultation with the healthcare professionals of their choice, so that they get decisions that are suitable and best for them as individuals. The government doesn't have the qualifications, the expertise, to do that, and so shouldn't be doing that. And but in mandating vaccines, they have removed from us the ability to make informed choices and to make those individualized choices in an arena of healthcare where choices should all be individual.
Right. So, in other words, when government was set up with a perfect checks and balances, the different elements of government, which is now also skewed and weighted too heavily probably in the executive branch, that's my own personal opinion, that also in regard to these other kinds of healthcare decisions and mandating vaccines and what role government plays in mandating these vaccines and having them in our healthcare system is also skewed and heavily balanced in a way that we are losing many of our individual rights. And that kind of leads right up to what our motto is for the show, really. It's creating awareness, educating before you vaccinate, and then actually taking action, which is, I think, as I've said many times before, why I admire what you've done, because you have taken action, not just for your family, but to share the information and then get out there and do something in the legal system. So I wanted to remind people that you have written an ebook, The Authoritative Guide, which can be found on the Homeopathy World Community website, and just click there and it'll take you directly to the place where you could get the ebook. And it provides information that people in every situation will need to make an informed decision about exemptions and waivers, which you are expert in. And you will help the people to determine whether or not that they can get through the vaccination exemption maze on their own, or whether they will need some guidance and assistance from an attorney and someone to be their advocate, their personal advocate. The most common questions regarding a religious exemption, which is a major question in people's mind, is going to be addressed in the ebook. And each state does have their own statutes and regulations. You can listen to our past shows regarding that. And therefore, individuals must always contact their state's agency that controls their own, the laws that govern them. We want people to understand and exercise their rights and to learn the limitations of the legal system. Once they've become learned, then they can join others to take action. And there is a development, you've been telling us all about it when it opened up, the development of the advocacy portal where people can work with other people who are interested in these issues to make legislative changes to help expand our rights. And do you want to tell a little bit about the National Vaccine Information Center website again so people know where to go and get help?
Sure. You can go to nvic.org. That's the National Vaccine Information Center. They're the nation's leading grassroots nonprofit organization. Been working for well over a couple of decades at this point to help educate and inform people and assist people who are dealing with vaccine injury issues. They're just terrific. And they have recently launched what they're calling the NVIC Advocacy Portal. What they have done is to put together the internet infrastructure to facilitate legislative initiatives that can be trying to pass legislation to expand our rights or to oppose legislation that is attempting to impose even more vaccine requirements or to restrict our freedom to choose. So there really can be two different aspects in that regard. They've got it set up there in the process of getting directors for every state in the country. I think they probably have or are working towards having directors for half of the states. I'm proud to be the NVIC Advocacy Portal Director for North Carolina, where I live. But got directors coming up. And I encourage people to go to, if you go to the NVIC.org site, there will be a link on the homepage there to the Advocacy Portal. You have to sign up for that. It doesn't cost anything, but you have to sign up for it, become a member or whatever they're calling it. But then you can get access to your state. Now, it's a new project. They're still in process or in progress, so it's going to be growing and building as we go. But get involved early. If your state doesn't have a director, if that's something you'd be interested in doing, then go ahead and contact Dawn Richardson, the woman who's spearheading this effort, and see if you can get set up to do that. And we hope to have, we're going to be looking for a sponsor for a bill here in North Carolina soon aimed at reforming the emergency health care laws that will allow people the freedom to refuse vaccines in a declared emergency. And as I know you know, Debbie, and your listeners may not be aware, though, most states have laws that in the context of a declared emergency, the state can mandate vaccines and exemptions go out the window. So while I am all for example, having philosophical exemptions in every state, and only 18 or 20 of them have that right now, to me it's an even higher priority to get these emergency laws reformed or modified to allow to refuse vaccines in a declared emergency, because in most laws, most states, the laws are drafted in such a way that they can mandate vaccines and without exemptions in a declared emergency. Mm-hmm. So the exemptions we have currently are contingent. We've never had an absolute right to refuse vaccines in this country, and I think we need to change that.
Mm-hmm. So this is really fine-tuning of the wording of the law that we have on the books already, and someone's going to have to be really good with legalese and know how to make it so that people will sign a bill in such a way or accept the legal rights of an individual in case of a declared emergency. And I don't know whether you're going to be involved with that, you know, but someone's going to have to really advocate. Go ahead.
Yeah, for that particular issue. Now, I've identified about a dozen different vaccine rights legislative issues, and I have a list on my vaccinerights.com website. But regarding the – and I've worked with people in other states to put together the legal information to present to state representatives for some other issues. But regarding the emergency, and I'm happy to do that, by the way, with folks anywhere who want my help, if I can help, I'm happy to do that. Regarding the emergency health rights issue, I've spent the last year and a half or so at this point pulling together information, and then recently wrote a document called the Swine Flu Review, where I've summarized and fully referenced information concerning the pandemic and how that was completely mishandled, and as a justification for the need to reform emergency health laws. And then I had the great pleasure and honor of working with a gal last summer and fall to put together draft legislation that's already in a preliminary form that could be handed to a state representative to say, here are the rights that we want. Now, you know, what starts as a proposed legislation and what maybe ends up getting enacted into law can be two different things.
Ahead.
But we have the tools put together, to make a long story short, to help people, to make this as easy as possible for anyone who wants to do the same thing in another state, or anyone who wants to join us here in North Carolina to get this going here. And the advocacy portal is going to be a tremendous help for organizing and pulling people together on vaccine legislative issues. So I really strongly encourage folks to hook into that system. And that's what I'll be relying on with my pandemic response project regarding the emergency health care rights. We're going to be relying and utilizing that NVIC advocacy portal tool substantially, I expect, over time.
Yes, I understand that you've been very involved and concerned about the pandemic response and the projects that you've been working on. The government will then have the potential to mandate these vaccinations and loss of individual rights. And I wanted to let people know out there a little bit more about pandemics and how governments are instituting vaccination programs, just to let people know that the governments of all these countries are really on board with vaccination, and they literally are inoculating millions of people. I have in Bangladesh starts a campaign to vaccinate 25 million children against polio, and this is a report December 12th. That was it was in 2007, so it's about 3 years old. And 700,000 Bangladesh health workers and volunteers started vaccinating 25 million children under the age of 5. Now, I don't know what the result of that campaign was. And then we have another campaign, September 14th, 2010. In Vietnam, there is a vaccination campaign to inoculate 7.5 million children against measles. And the Vietnam's Ministry of Health launched this campaign to the children ages 9 years old to 18 months against measles. And so I'm wondering what the outcome of that's going to be as well. But you can see that these governments are on board with the vaccination programs. That's a lot of inoculant that's purchased. And there's another report, October 26, 2010, Africa seizes the chance against polio. More than 72 million children will be immunized across 15 countries to tackle the risks of polio. I guess polio is of more concern in those countries. It says Africa seizes the unprecedented chance to inoculate all those people, and a total of 290,000 vaccinators, so that's employment for those people, have been mobilized to go door-to-door to deliver 2 drops of oral polio vaccine to every child under the age of 5 in areas considered at highest risks of polio transmission. And maybe people who are in our age bracket remember polio concerns, the epidemic in the United States, and how we took the sugar pills and that kind of thing. Do you have any comment regarding this? I know it's not maybe your area of expertise, but just what is going on in the world?
Well, there's a huge financial component to this, of course. There was a recent article pointing out that there were over 330 vaccines either in development or on the market currently. Every man, woman, and child on the planet is a potential recipient of vaccines from the moment of birth until, and as I like to say a little bit facetiously, till the last vaccine takes them out. And, it's an enormous market, and my God, you can go to one of the most heavily vaccinated countries in the world, the United States, you can sell your vaccines there, and you don't even have any liability if they injure or kill people. So, I mean, what could be a better deal than that? You know, so mm-hmm. from a cold calculating business point of view, this is big bucks, and it's a feeding frenzy. Now, from a health point of view, we're not going to hear, well, you'll hear about it in non-mainstream news sources, but you won't hear about it on mainstream news, certainly not here in the U.S. You won't hear about all the death and disability that is a result of the vaccines. You'll hear about, you know, how wonderful it is that they've all got these vaccines and they're now safe from such and such a disease.
Mm-hmm.
You won't hear about the people who get polio from the polio vaccine, but that occurs. The drops are I believe, a live viral vaccine.
So that means that if it's a live vaccine, that means every time they go to the bathroom, they're contagious to anybody who's near them. And then if they in an unsanitation condition and it goes into the water and they go in and wash themselves or clean their clothes, they're potentially in contact with a live virus. Is that correct?
Yes, as I understand it, it is. And that was part of the, also as I understand it, that was actually a deliberate part of the strategy, was that if they couldn't get to everybody because the live vaccine virus is transmissible, they would be vaccinating other people by contact. And isn't that a wonderful thing?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if it is or not, frankly. I think based on the research I've done over the years, that the entire theory of vaccination has some pretty significant flaws in it, and there's a lot of false information asserted in support of vaccines, and one of the biggest ones you already alluded to earlier, you know, something on the order of, on average, of about 90% of disease decline preceded vaccines, and other diseases which had no vaccines declined at the same time across the 1900s. So clearly there's something other than vaccines that has caused and the vast majority of, an overwhelming majority of disease decline. And we have documentation with polio and smallpox in particular, and I recall reading other things about diphtheria in World War II, where various countries that were vaccinated actually had much higher disease rates than those that didn't. But I'm more familiar with the information on polio, and here in the U.S. in particular, that polio had been declining by the time the first vaccine came out, and it actually reversed those declines for a couple of years. And that fact was covered up by health authorities. They redefined polio so that, for example, aseptic meningitis was now diagnosed separately as aseptic meningitis and not as polio. They redefined what it took to qualify statistically for paralysis. Originally, if you had paralysis for 24 hours, I believe, you know, you'd be listed as paralysis from polio. Well, a lot of people had paralysis temporarily. It was only a small minority of people who had permanent paralysis. Not that it's good ever. You know, I'm not saying it's okay to be paralyzed, but
right.
But the effects
were... But it
were,
wasn't. It wasn't included in the statistics, and we do know that statistics can be manipulated in a way. If you cut out a little piece of a graph and only show certain pieces, or you change the numbers in such a way that it's going to promote whatever it is your theory is.
Well,
or
they change the definitions, and when you change the definitions, the exact same conditions give you different numbers. And so they change definitions to make the numbers go down to deliberately and falsely give the impression that the vaccine had a positive effect. There were a couple of states that stopped vaccinating with the polio vaccine because they saw it having the opposite effect that it was supposed to have. It wasn't that this went unnoticed, but it was all but unnoticed by the general public and not information that was promoted through mainstream media. And so we have continued to use that lie as a basis for the presumably necessary mass immunization policy for all these diseases and more vaccines coming down the pipeline for all kinds of other diseases and non-disease things. You know, they're trying to do vaccines for cocaine addiction. And I mean, it's again, it's a pharmaceutical feeding frenzy is really what it is.
Alan, I'm sorry. I don't want to cut you off.
No,
we've got about 10 or some more listeners in the chat room, and there's some comments here. Its question is, has anyone ever proven that a pandemic has been stopped by vaccinations? I don't know that we have that information at our fingertips. That's a good question. So that's why
I'd love to respond to that, though.
Oh, go ahead.
I don't have an answer to that direct question, but I'll tell you, when I was looking at statistics, and this is in my swine flu review, when I was looking at vaccine statistics, the U.S. reportedly vaccinated 30% of the population against swine flu last year and perhaps on into early 2010. And we had, based on the available numbers, we had 8 times our proportional share in terms of our population, proportional share of the world swine flu deaths. The UK vaccinated 8% of their population, roughly a fourth proportionally to what the US did, and they had one-fourth of what we had. They had only twice their proportional share. Poland did not vaccinate as a nation against the swine flu.
Right.
And they had one-tenth of their proportional share of swine flu deaths. So based on those 3 countries and the available statistics, it seemed like the use of pandemic vaccines had exactly the opposite of the intended effect. Now,
okay.
You can question, you know, where those numbers came from and so forth, but even
I wonder if that included all of the miscarriages. because there was a lot of reports and there's a lot of
information. No, I'm not talking about the vaccine. I'm talking about the disease. That when countries vaccinated, the number of disease deaths, not vaccine deaths, disease deaths, was higher in based on those three countries as a sampling. There was a direct correlation between the disease death rate and the vaccination rate, suggesting that the use of the vaccine was counterproductive without even considering the vaccine adverse events, which is a whole other question.
Right.
Yes, there were, you know, various reported swine flu injuries and deaths, but again, we don't know, you know, what that is compared to the actual deaths and disability caused by the vaccine, because we know that most of that doesn't get reported.
We have somebody on the chat who gave us a link to the child health safety, and there are graphs there which indicate the vaccine rates, you know, in the different – I'll have to take a look at that, but I'll put it on the blog, and there are charts that we can look at about the rates of vaccine deaths and or the rate of disease that has continued or declined in a region. So this is why it's so controversial, because I think governments, once they're headstrong and have invested multi-billions of dollars into a kind of a program, how do you turn around and go back? And that's something that the government itself is having problems economically and politically today in all different kinds of arenas, and this is just one of them where a kind of saving face, or, you know, if you find out actual information, it's hard to actually look at it squarely in the face and recognize it and take it as science and take it as fact, because you're so invested in this other way of doing things.
Well,
that's my own take on it.
Yeah, I believe the people at the CDC know, for example, that vaccines cause autism. The studies that have been relied on to claim that they don't do not hold up to scrutiny. It's I've seen the analysis at a conference, and the studies just don't hold water. Then there's tremendous amount of scientific research supporting a vaccine autism connection. So again, I think it's politics. It's politics that people there. It may be that they fear that if the truth is known, that it will cause such widespread distrust or revolt or what have you with regard to established medicine, which, you know, in my view would ultimately be a positive thing, but I can certainly see the resistance to doing that. So,
well, our time is up today, and what I want to do is thank you once again for a really quick show, and I will just maybe continue on and on next Thursday with our line of thinking, our talking, and I want to encourage people to click that button to get the ebook, The Authoritative Guide to Vaccination Exemptions, that our wonderful guest speaker has talked about today, and we'll see you the next time, okay? Is that good?
Thanks. That's great. Yeah, thanks, Debbie.
Thank
it's a great pleasure
so
to be here as always.
Okay, let's listen to you sing us out.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate. But now we know.
allow our souls to shine. Reaching for the greater love and healing for mankind. Share your light, let your love be your light.